Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
It's great to be back on the show.
Just before we went on air, you saying this: the graphs included in this story are scary. And the headline is, the Bank of Canada has identified two risk factors to the Canadian economy. What are those factors?
Well, high household indebtedness and high house prices. They say elevated level of household indebtedness and high house prices. Well, that's exactly what I was writing about in 2015 in the first edition, and then again in 2018 in the second edition of the book. And nothing happened. It was entirely within the scope of the Bank of Canada to do something about that in terms of making sure that people weren't allowed to borrow, to go that deeply into debt. And I guess I shouldn't say entirely. They would have had to cooperate with the regulator of the banks and other lenders, but it could be done. I mean, the government could have done it, and they didn't do it. And so they got a bunch of graphs here. And one of them just really popped out at me. Actually, two of them, they're related. So in 2020, the system, which is mostly banks, originated 280,000 mortgages, and it's now dropped down to 140,000. And the average prior to that surge in 2020, COVID, to call it the COVID surge, was about 200,000 a year. So it was a tremendous jump that's like 40% jump in the amount of new mortgages taken out. But then the even scarier one is, they keep track of how risky these mortgages are by comparing the people in terms of their income and the loan, the size of the loan they're taking out, and the threshold they have for the riskiest borrowers is if the loan is bigger than 450% of the income in the household, so 4.5 times. And the 26% of all mortgages in that period, that late 2020, early 2021 period, were in that 450% ratio segment, which is, you know, normally considered extremely dangerous to lend money to those people. At least I would say most people consider that. And the long-term average, if you look back, going back to 2014, was between 12% and 18%. So it jumped to 26%. So in other words, not only were they handing out of like 40% more mortgages during the 2020 to 2022 period, but they were also handing them out to people that couldn't really handle the amount of debt that they were giving them. And they must have known they were doing that. And so there must have been a deliberate policy put out. I don't think it was ever announced. I would have noticed it if there was any public announcement. But there must have been something behind closed doors with the lenders and the government to say, go ahead and just shovel the money out the door. And you'll remember that was when people were buying places in Oshawa and way outside of the major cities, sight unseen. And they didn't, there was such a frenzy of buying that they didn't have time to sell their property, you know, maybe in the case of Toronto, in the Toronto proper, to buy a house in Oshawa. They were just adding another property on, and houses in Oshawa get up to $1 million. Well, now that part of Toronto, Peterborough, Oshawa, the other outlying cities like that, that are like a 2-hour commute on the train, the prices have been dropping ever since they peaked in 2022. So all of those people will be in trouble. And unless they can get a way to put some more capital into their is pay down the size of the mortgage. But most of them won't be able to do that. There's another graph here. It says share of all new mortgages with mortgage debt service ratio greater than 25%. And now that has jumped up to 35%, up from 15 to 20%. So there's clear signs that the lending was reckless, I guess would be a simple word with a lot of emotion in it. Reckless lending to people that probably shouldn't have been allowed to borrow that much money. Now we're starting to see so the way it works with houses is you don't go bankrupt right away. You go bankrupt slowly, as the old saying, and then suddenly. So, but it takes a long time for people, the CMHC and the banks, they don't, you miss a payment, you miss two payments, they don't jump on it right away. So, but there is a category that talks about people that are behind at least 60 days, and that number has jumped up to a high number, a recent high. Only time it was higher was in the middle of COVID when they were allowed to skip mortgage payments at that point. So they'll remember that they were given a break from having to make the mortgage payments. So here we are today, almost 4 years later. Well, we are 4 years later, right? March 2024 is 4 years. 4 years later, and what we have is a whole bunch more debt in the hands of a bunch of people that probably shouldn't be having that much debt. And we've got house prices coming down in most parts of the country, except maybe not in Alberta.
And what's the story with Alberta real estate? Calgary, for example?
Well, everybody's moving to Alberta. Yeah. I don't know if they're leaving behind their situation in other parts. But then now the government of Alberta is even offering a incentive of $5,000 if you move to Alberta to take out. You have to be in certain employment categories, I think, to qualify. But if you move here and you stay, you get a bonus of $5,000. Well, it's actually a tax refund, I guess, when you file your taxes. So. And there's, the thing about Edmonton and Calgary and other Red Deer, other places in Alberta is there's lots of land. I've tested this out in Edmonton and Calgary both. You can drive in 30 minutes, you can be out in farmland in both of those cities. So there's lots of room to expand, low rise housing. Unlike Toronto, Vancouver, where it would be very difficult to expand low rise housing that was affordable. But, and real prices have crept a little higher in Edmonton. They're still not high compared to Toronto and Vancouver, but they're higher than they were.
Yeah, I remember interviewing the Calgary Real Estate Board president, and he said the only thing stopping Calgary from expanding is Edmonton to the north, the Rockies to the west, the U.S. border to the south, and Regina to the east.
Regina, oh my God. There's cheap houses in Regina. You can certainly... they've had issues in Calgary with expanding and stuff, but it's really quite easy to get around in Calgary. Everybody complains now about the traffic in Calgary and Edmonton, but I think if somebody moved from Vancouver, they would just laugh at anybody complaining about Calgary and Edmonton traffic. So you guys have no idea how good you have it. So.
Oh, I know what you guys call rush hour in Edmonton is called midnight in Vancouver.
Right. So the weird thing about, you'd think there'd be less traffic with everybody working from home, but I guess, I don't know, I guess people don't stay home. Just because they're working from home doesn't mean they stay home, right? They might go have other things they have to go and do. So sometimes of the day there's quite a bit of traffic, but no, it's certainly not the rush hours that Toronto and Vancouver get. And it's a good thing because we don't have a transit system built up. And Calgary's got a pretty good one. Edmonton doesn't have a very good one at all. So anyway, I think, I feel like this elevated household debt, indebtedness and high house prices in Canada are going to be a major problem. And all you have to do is look at a place like China, where about 3 years ago, you and I started talking about on this show about a company called Evergrande, which was which was a major developer. I mean, the numbers are just phenomenal. $200 billion worth of debt equivalent, and about $40 billion of it was foreign debt, and the rest was local Chinese debt. And that company went bankrupt. Another company called Country Garden, which at the time was considered the top one, and it was the safest one, it more recently, say probably about a year ago, got into trouble, and it's now gone bankrupt or insolvent, and it's being liquidated. And now another one, Vanke, V-A-N-K-E, is which was one of the very first ones. It was originated in 1991 in Shenzhen. It is now in trouble, and the government is being asked to bail it out. And the government actually owns 30. One of the governments in China owns 35% of it, and the government-controlled banks would be asked to do it, but. But the problem is that the Chinese are not sure if they want to bail these guys out. They you think if they wanted to save the Chinese real estate market for residential, this is all residential I'm talking about, they would have done something by now. So it's going to be extremely difficult. What they're really concerned about is there's a bunch of buildings that are unfinished, and the average person, the average family would put a down payment on one of those apartments. And they would be expecting to see a finished unit come. A lot of them use them as investments. They don't necessarily move into them. They keep them pristine and brand new. They don't move into them, so they're more like a place to use as an investment that hopefully would grow in value. But that dream probably is fading pretty quickly now. So now they just want somebody to make sure that they. The deposit they put down isn't completely lost if the building were not finished. So they want somebody to finish the building. But this is a problem. But, you know, the Chinese premier, not Xi Jinping, but another one below, just one level below him, said that something like, I'm paraphrasing now, if they're in trouble, they should just be allowed to go bankrupt and be liquidated. Like, it doesn't sound like a... In North America, there'd be a bailout, right? In the capitalist free enterprise society, we'd be bailing them out. So, but in the communist Chinese society, they're letting them go bankrupt. So it's pretty hard to figure it out. But it's happening, and it's really a big issue, I'm sure, for not just the financial sector in China, because the banks would all be involved. The big banks would all be involved in property lending, as they are all over the world. Yes. But the government, they don't get voted out, but they can't afford to have a billion really unhappy people out there that are losing their life savings on a property investment. So I'm sure the government's very worried about it, but so far they haven't, they did talk about a bailout, but the numbers are very, very small. So it's only just enough money just to get the developer to finish some of the current projects. But not nearly enough to save the company.
Well, at one point, Evergrande was the biggest real estate company in the world.
Yeah, and with the most debt. And while there is one company in Canada called Brookfield, it's actually probably more of a New York company that maybe is a little bigger than those Chinese ones. They have something like $400 billion in assets and $200 billion in debt, or $300 billion in assets, $200 billion. So it's roughly the same size, But Brookfield is more. It has a residential division, but it's more things like office towers and shopping centers, which means it has its own set of problems as well. And Brookfield's also expanded a lot into infrastructure and that. But these companies in China, they're pretty much focused on just residential. And I mean, with the 1.2 billion people, you could see that they could get to be pretty big, but. But you know, obviously, they borrowed too much money, and now the numbers, like the sale numbers for January, February, are out. And of course, there's always a slump because of the holiday, the lunar holiday. But I think the numbers are something like 34% lower than last year with the sales, and for the Vanke, the latest one that's in trouble, last year was a really low point. So to be 34% lower than that would be pretty difficult. The sales numbers have been really low for a couple of years now. So once people get a whiff of maybe it's not a good investment, then things start to change rapidly, because you're asking the buyer to take on a lot of debt. And for what? You know, they're not really buying a productive asset. They're buying a speculation more than a productive investment that doesn't pay any dividends or interest. In fact, it you have to keep feeding your money into it a little bit, because so if the price isn't rising all the time, it doesn't work out for the average person at all.
According to Google, Keller Williams Realty of Austin, Texas is the biggest in the world, and Brookfield is second biggest in the world, and then CBRE headquarters in Los Angeles, third biggest in the world. So Evergrande has really fallen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those companies are different. So the Evergrande, of course, is building, completing and selling, which takes a lot more capital than somebody like CBRE, which is just really living off the commissions of trading. So they show a lot of revenue, but they don't have a lot of capital that need to put into it. So so that means you don't have to borrow a lot of money. Brookfield is definitely North America's most important company of that type, I think. And a lot of people are wondering about Brookfield because they have a very opaque and complex accounting system. They've got a bunch of subsidiaries. They've got several listed versions of Brookfield, they don't have very good disclosure as to what they don't have disclosure, for example, at the project by project level. So you can't tell, well, how is that shopping center doing, or how is that office tower doing, or how, you know. Other companies in the sector will give you that disclosure, but not Brookfield. So, but they've been very successful. They've been very good at borrowing money and making it work. And so, it's actually the a couple of their big projects that they got a hold of years ago were some of the office towers in downtown Manhattan and Canary Wharf, just outside of London, England. And they got those. After, you might remember, some people might remember this, a company called Olympia York, which was the biggest real estate company in Canada, at one time headquartered in Toronto, and they went bankrupt in about 1991 in that downturn. Brookfield picked up the pieces when, of course, they bought them probably at a fire sale price in the bankruptcy of Olympia York. So maybe the cycle just keeps going. So, I mean, if you have friendly lenders and you've got a problem that some of your buildings are, you know, under, like Brookfield, for example, has walked away from two big office towers in Los Angeles, the two biggest office towers in Los Angeles. Brookfield just walked away from them. So any money they'd invested in them, they lost. But the debt was what they called non-recourse. So they didn't have any liability if they walked away. So the people that had lent the money became the new owners of those two office towers. It's happened in some other cities as well. It's happened in, I'm not sure if it's happened in Toronto, but it's happened in some of the other big U.S. cities where people have just walked away from their projects. So the equity's all gone. In my weekend note, which everybody's welcome to sign up for, comes out on Friday. I did a report on that a few weeks ago. In Manhattan and in other places like Seattle and San Francisco, some of the office towers are now selling at less than 50 cents on the dollar. So it's getting to be pretty scary with the debt. So we started out talking about China, but now, you know, it's certainly a problem, not just with, you know, a few over-levered Canadian household buyers with household debt, but it's a problem with large corporations like Brookfield that have borrowed a lot of money to buy real estate, because they always say, I've been four decades of presentations by these companies, and they always say, well, we never borrow more than 50 or 60% of the value of the asset at the time that we buy it, so we're covered, we're safe. Because so I you know, if that's actually fully true, I don't know, but at any rate, having 40% equity and 60% borrowing is safe, unless the building drops more than 50%. Then now you're now all of your equity gone, and not only is all your equity gone, but the building's less than your debt. Right? So, you know, they used to call that being upside down on your mortgage. Well, it happens to big corporations as well. And I'm sure it's happening in China. So the thing about real estate bubbles bursting is that when they burst, they take a long time to sort out because there's such a difficult selling. Usually a lender seizes the property and sells it, right? And that's the way things go. But when you've got a whole bunch of properties being seized and the lenders are all trying to foreclose and liquidate their, even if they have to take a loss, they'd rather just get out of it. There may not be enough buyers to meet all those sellers. So it can take years to sort it out. Certainly it took years in the 1980s when previous crisis, there was a crisis in Canada. Then there was the late 80s, there was a savings and loan crisis in the U.S. And then the early 90s, there was that Olympia New York thing. And there was a bunch of trust companies that went under at that time. So that was like a decade of difficulties. And of course, this bubble is much, much bigger than any bubble that existed in the 80s and the 90s.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, is the U.S. Reserve asking banks to hold more cash back just in case things go sideways?
Yeah, just a little background on this. So the banks like to operate with the least amount of capital in their balance sheet structure. And the reason they like that is because they like to show a high return on equity. So the smallest amount of capital, the highest return, and you've got a really nice return on equity. And, you know, in Canada, the banks, prior to recently, they've been operating as high as 25 or 30% return on equity in Canadian on the Canadian division, and it's much lower in the U.S. And that's because of the regulatory rules. So in Canada, we allow banks to hold a very small amount of in fact, almost zero capital against housing mortgages. So that's why they have such a high return on capital. They make a small profit on every mortgage, but they don't have to allocate any capital to that business, and they make it out like bandits. Now the U.S., they followed the international system. It's called Basel III, and it's an accord that started in Switzerland at the Basel is the name of the city where all the international bankers agreed. But it's not mandatory. It's just a guideline. So what they did was they started at like 5% capital, and then they've lately been bumping it up to 10% capital. And after those three or four banks went under in March of 2023, so about a year ago, remember a Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank, because Silicon Valley is probably the one that people remember the best, was a quite a large bank, like $200 or $300 billion in assets. And they had speculated on government bonds, believe it or not, which, by the way, have a zero capital requirement for government bonds. You can buy as many government bonds with as much value as you want. There's no zero capital required because they're considered totally safe. And then what happened was interest rates went up. So they had a huge loss on all these government bonds that they bought. And depositors got wind of that, and they pulled all the money out of Silicon Valley Bank. So it ceased to exist at that point. So, and then recently, there's a company called New York Community Bank, which is mostly mortgages on multifamily housing in the Manhattan area. And it's also gotten into trouble, and the stock's gone down 75% in the last since January 1st. So, but before the New York Bank got into trouble, the regulators were getting worried because of what happened last March. So they put out a proposal to say that the bank should be required to hold, and I don't like to use that word, I'll explain in a minute, 20% capital. And that's much, much higher than the 5 or 10% that we're talking about, or zero in the case of Canadian mortgages insured by CMHC. So, of course, the bank lobby industry, which is the biggest group of lobbyists in Washington, D.C., by the way, there's 486 of them I was able to count up. I'm sure there's more than that, actually, but officially there's 486. There's only 535 people elected in Congress, 435 House of Representatives plus 100 senators. So there's almost one for one lobbyists. Like, can you imagine? I have this vision of a politician's waiting room, and there's always this lobbyist sitting there just saying, you know, can I get you anything? Can I, you know, can we go out for lunch? Can we go out for dinner? I just want to talk to you about the new rules. And what the lobbyist is telling the media and the elected people, they're telling them a bit of a fib. And the fib is that if they're required to hold 20% capital, then it'll hurt the economy, it'll hurt borrowers, and it'll tighten up the availability of credit. And the reason that that's not true is that, and this is where the big misconception comes up, is that if you hold 20% capital, you don't have to hold it. So that's why I don't like that term. It's just a different way of funding the bank. The bank can issue debt and raise money by debt, or it can issue shares and raise money by shares. And that money, as soon as the bank issues those shares or their debt, they can use it for whatever they want. They can lend it out, or they can buy government bonds with it, or whatever. There's no restriction on that money. It's just that the banks like to maintain the highest amount of leverage, the lowest amount of equity, the highest amount of debt, because that makes their profits look better. And so it's a return on equity that they're trying to maximize. And so when the lobbyists talk to the media and stuff, they say, oh, well, you know, if you make them hold all that money, they got to set aside all that money. Well, they don't set it aside. It's not set aside. So this is, and actually the fellow that wrote the book, Too Big to Fail, Andrew Ross Sorkin, in about the last week or so came out and said, you know what, he apologized for having used this thing. He called the capital they have to set aside a rainy day fund, which is, you know, very, very misleading. And he got it explained to him that that's not the way it works. Of course, nobody understands how it works. And he said, you know what, we've been misleading the public on this, and all the media people are doing it. So, and of course, nobody digs into, I've even seen people in central banks and economists that work for banks and stuff, and it's hard to tell whether they know what they're saying is wrong, but they're going along with the talking points of the lobbyists, or whether they actually don't understand it. My guess is maybe they don't understand it because it's fairly complicated. And I didn't understand it until I wrote the book about when the bubble burst, and I forced myself to dig into it. So anyway, 20% equity would be way better for everybody, maybe even including the banks, but especially for everybody else, the borrowers, the depositors, the government, the taxpayer. Everybody would benefit because the chances of them needing a bailout would be much less, of course, because the first buffer for losses, if they happen to incur losses, is the equity. So if they only have a 5% or 10% buffer, then one or two bad years in the real estate market, all the capital is going to be gone. If they have a 20% buffer, they can survive much more easily. So, but don't hold your breath waiting for a 20% requirement, because they put that number out last June or July. The lobbyists have been working really hard ever since. And Jay Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, who also is the regulator of the banks, by the way, in the U.S., so as head of the regulator, he said, well, you know, we're going to have to do make some adjustments to that. So the lobbyists have gotten to him. So at any rate, the banks will, I'm sure they'll win this battle, and it'll, we'll continue to see, the requirement for bailouts in the bank industry, which is really unfortunate because, they make just a gazillion dollars, and then the government bails them out, and then they do it all over again. So it's a really odd system. I don't know why people. I really think people should be up in arms about it. But obviously, it's one of those things that people don't get excited about, except when there's a crisis, of course. Now that I think about it, though, wasn't there something called Occupy Wall Street? And when the banks were bailed out in 2009, people were pretty upset about that.
And on the interesting front, there's going to be a Titanic 2.
Yeah, there's a billionaire from Australia that wants to make an exact replica of it, which I'm I didn't know there was two of them. We were talking off air. You said that the other one was used for transporting troops or something, the Olympic and the Titanic. But I think he's only making one, and it's actually quite a small ship by modern standards. I think it said it was 42 or 50,000 ton displacement, which is still fairly big, but tiny compared to modern ships. And I don't know if it'll have extra, if it'll, you know, there was a flaw. I mean, I don't know. I didn't read any book on it, but I watched the movie. I don't think the movie mentioned it, but there was a flaw in the hull construction that it would have been more likely to not go under if the bulkheads had been designed differently. So
yeah, the watertight bulkheads didn't go all the way up to the deck. So you had the ice cube tray effect where the water slopped along. Also, the iron used on the Titanic was very brittle, so it shattered, and it ripped along the side of the ship, like the Costa Concordia that capsized in the Mediterranean because it was ripped along the side of the ship. So a ship can float if five or six watertight areas are compromised, but if 13, 14 are flooded, no, the ship goes down.
Yeah. Yeah, too much water, and then you're sitting too low in the water, and then.
And also, if it's
if they just put those bulkheads right up to the top, they would have been fine. They just didn't believe it would ever happen, I guess.
Well, no, it was ripped along the side, so even if the bulkheads were there, if you flood enough, the Titanic, they did anticipate ice. It had a double collision bulkhead in the bow. If they would have just plowed straight into the iceberg, they might have survived as well, because they had extra protection from icebergs there, but not along the whole side of the ship.
Yeah.
But your instinct is to try to steer away from a collision, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. Well, you know, I did quite a bit of sailing. I'd still like to do some more, but it doesn't happen as often anymore. And when you're in big waves, you definitely want to take them head on. You don't want to try and go sideways, because you'll get rolled over on your side. And so you turn into the wave if you can. But I don't know about an iceberg. I've never had to make that decision in a sailboat.
At first, I was thinking if he's in Australia, they don't have to worry about icebergs. But the biggest icebergs in the world come off Antarctica, which isn't that far from Australia.
Yeah, New Zealand is closer, and but still 1,000 kilometers away, probably. So I don't know if the Antarctic. I did read recently about the Western Australia ice sheet, which is breaking up much faster than they thought. It was going to take until 2100 to 2200 for a couple of these pieces of ice to come off, but they started to show cracks in them already. And one big one, the Larsen B and A and C, they've all broken off. And now they're quite worried, because the latest report, it just came out in October 2023, was that if the full, now this is a pretty big if, we're not there yet, but in the event that the full Western Australia ice sheet came off, it would be 5 meters of sea increase in the sea levels worldwide. That's how much ice is in that ice sheet. And that's just on the western side. It's a whole continent, right? It's a huge, huge continent. And then there's also Greenland. But Greenland is only one-tenth the size of Antarctica. And then there's the Tibetan Plateau, which is the third biggest one, which has glaciers on it. And it's, you know, much smaller than Antarctica. And Greenland, of course, but it's a pretty important source of water for everybody in India and China and Nepal and all these places. So, anyway, that's a digression.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, if it's an accurate representation of the Titanic. Will you want to share steerage with 708 other of your closest friends?
I don't imagine the conditions. Well,
there were 709 There were 709 passengers in steerage, and most of them died.
Yeah, but in the movie, it looked like they were having way more fun, because they had music, they were dancing, they were enjoying themselves, whereas the people upstairs were all stuffy and nobody was laughing, and everybody was, you know, kind of like, you know.
Well, if they're Australian,
too
they'll
tense,
be...
Too uptight.
Yeah, if they're Australian, yeah. they'll be drunk by 8 in the morning.
No, no.
That's been my cruising experience. Well, I don't know. An Australian told me this joke. What do you call an Australian who doesn't drink? Dead. Apologies to all of our non-drinking Australian friends. Hilliard?
Exactly.
Hilliard, yeah. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Nice to be on your show, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Find him on X at HMacBE. If you have any questions for Hilliard or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com, our YouTube channel, Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.